Welcome to the first ever episode of Cold Case Detectives Too Close to Home, a monthly Patreon-sponsored series where we select five Patreon supporters at random and examine cases featuring their hometowns. If you'd like to see your own hometown featured, you can check out our Patreon linked below. And now, let's dive into the stories that haunt the streets of your hometowns. The mysteries that strike too close to home. Elsie Frost. The city of Wakefield in West Yorkshire was chosen by our patron supporter Max Hay and has a surprisingly grisly history of cold cases for a town that appears so picturesque on the surface. Its most notorious case is perhaps that of Elsie Frost. Described as a model child, 14-year-old Elsie Frost excelled in school and was expected to become head girl. Her younger brother, Colin, fondly recalled memories of her teaching him how to tie his shoelaces, and he told one local newspaper that she was more like a mother to him than a sister. But Elsie never got to realize her full potential or start her own family, as her life was unjustly taken from her one afternoon in the autumn months of 1965. Elsie spent the afternoon of October 9th with friends at Snapthorpe School's Sailing Club on Horbury Lagoon, a flooded gravel quarry next to Calder and Hevel Canal. It had been a fun day, but it was soon time to go home. The group of girls left between 3:50 and 4 p.m. to head back. However, Elsie decided to take a different route to the other girls, possibly because she didn't want to get her new shoes muddy. The teenager opted to walk through the tunnel between the railway line which ran between Wakefield Kirkgate Station and Horbury. It was here that Elsie was viciously attacked. She was stabbed a total of 5 times, twice in the head, twice in the back, and once in the hands. One of these wounds pierced her heart, and the young girl shortly passed away from shock and blood loss. Before passing away, Elsie managed to stumble through the underpass before collapsing at the bottom of a set of stairs on the other side. She was found at around 4:12 p.m. by a man who was out with his young children. The investigation that subsequently occurred was the biggest that the town of Wakefield had ever seen. Over 1,200 statements were taken, 4,000 people were traced and their movements checked, and 12,000 men were interviewed. A vast amount of knives were examined, and the manhunt for the perpetrator even involved the army, as well as metal detectors. Despite all their hard work, however, authorities could not establish any motive for the teenager's ruthless murder. It was unknown if Elsie had been specifically targeted, or if she was tragically simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. Then the case took a turn when, in January of 1966, the deputy coroner at the time accused a 33-year-old man named Ian Bernard Spencer of being the guilty party. However, Spencer insisted he was innocent and maintained that he was at home at the time of Elsie's death. His alibi was corroborated by several friends and family members, but these witnesses were never called to give evidence at the inquest. Eventually, Spencer was cleared by 2 courts, but despite this, police investigators regularly turned up at his door, often after there had been a knife crime in the area, and they wanted to check up on him. After Spencer was cleared of involvement, Elsie's case began to grow cold. It wasn't until 2015 that the investigation was reopened. Authorities were shocked but delighted that they were met with hundreds of new lines of inquiry. The downside of this new investigation was that most of the original files from 1965 had been destroyed, leaving investigators back at square one. There was also no possibility of obtaining DNA from Elsie's clothing, because it too had been destroyed when the Frosts had declined to keep it after her death. Theories in Elsie's case were limited too. One theory that was floated around at the time was that perhaps the teenager had stumbled upon two gay men in a compromising position, as engaging in what was termed homosexual activity at the time was illegal in the United Kingdom. Others have speculated that perhaps the 14-year-old was meeting a boyfriend. Her parents noted that the day before her passing, Elsie had gone to the local youth club in her best clothing and asked to stay out later than normal, although she had returned home at her usual time. At one point, a nurse came forward claiming that she'd heard a man in hospital confessing to Elsie's murder, claiming that he'd been engaged in sex acts with another man. However, this account was never able to be verified by police. A year later, in September of 2016, things finally began to look up. The Thames Valley Police Department announced that they had arrested a 78-year-old man in connection with the case. The man was subsequently bailed but rearrested in March of 2017. In March of 2018, the man was named as Peter Pickering. He had been convicted of the 1972 manslaughter of Shirley Baldy, a 14-year-old girl from Wombwell, near the town of Barnsley. Pickering had died the day before his identity was revealed to the public. According to Detective Superintendent Nick Wallen of the West Yorkshire Police, authorities had strongly suspected that Pickering was responsible, and that, if he hadn't died, the Crown Prosecution Service would have charged him with Elsie's slaying. Pickering also reportedly had a history of sexual assault and grievous bodily harm, and had spent some 40 years of his life in custody. He was dubbed the Beast of Wombwell. At the time of Elsie's slaying, Pickering was wanted by police in relation to the sexual assaults of two 16-year-old girls. His girlfriend had recently rescinded the alibi she had given him, and in the letters he wrote to her upon finding this out, he claimed he was so angry and upset that he was going to take someone else's life. The worst part of all of this, however, is that the police were actually made aware of Pickering just days after Elsie's murder. He was never apprehended by police at the time, as he could not be located, and by the time he was found, Ian Spencer had been charged with the crime. Officially, Elsie's case is still unresolved, but authorities are confident that this time they have the right man, even if he wasn't able to be prosecuted for his heinous actions. Gail Whitehouse. Wolverhampton in the West Midlands was chosen by our patron, Andrea. Initially a market town, Wolverhampton boomed during the Industrial Revolution, becoming a major centre for coal mining and vehicle manufacturing. However, it has also become known for hosting some of the United Kingdom's darkest crimes. On Thursday, September 6th of 1990, two teenagers found the body of a woman just 75 yards from Steelhouse Lane, dumped in the bushes like trash. She was soon identified by authorities as 23-year-old Gail Whitehouse, a local sex worker and mother of two young boys. Immediately, the local police department knew that they would have their work cut out for them. Violence against sex workers was tragically commonplace, and their lifestyle meant that the suspect pool would be large. Nonetheless, investigators immediately got to work. Gail lived on Mayfield Road and was last seen on Monday, September 3rd. Before she went out that night, she left her sons with her usual babysitter, but failed to ever collect them, indicating to authorities that she had been killed before returning home. It was also uncovered that shortly before her death, a judge had quashed Gail's backlog of fines for soliciting, which amounted to £4,000, to give her a fresh start. After dropping the children off with the sitter, Gail started work at around 6:30 p.m, standing on the corner of Steelhouse Lane. She was last seen getting into a green car with two Asian men and returned 30 minutes later. At around 9:20 p.m, another witness pulled up outside a local wines and spirits shop for cigarettes. He noticed Gail speaking with an Asian man. When he returned from purchasing his cigarettes, the witness then watched the 23-year-old go across the street to a gold Cortina stopped in the Royal Hospital car park, where another Asian man waited. The trio then drove off together. According to investigators, the men brought Gale back to the area and they were never considered suspects. A fellow sex worker and friend of Gale's claimed that after this, she left the young woman standing on Steelhouse Lane to go with a client at around 10 p.m. Approximately 10 minutes later, two witnesses saw a woman who resembled Gale talking to someone in a lorry cab and claimed that it looked as if she was trying to enter the vehicle. If this woman was Gale, it is the last known sighting of the 23-year-old alive. The make and model of the truck is unknown, but it is thought to be a grey or silver colour. Gale was gone by the time her friend returned. Early on in the investigation, authorities also attempted to trace a white car, possibly an Austin Metro, which was seen that Monday night at the conjunction of Cable Street, Steelhouse Lane, and Caledonia Road at around 11:30 p.m. It is unknown why investigators wanted to locate the car, but it does not appear to have ever been found. Despite offering anonymity to anyone who came forward with information, Gale's case largely stalled due to a lack of cooperation from the public and fellow sex workers. Almost 40 undercover police officers attempted to search for clues shortly after the investigation began, but they all came up empty. 500 drivers were stopped by police during the course of their investigation, and a reconstruction was made for TV, but again, no new leads came forward. Investigators ruled out robbery as a motive for the slaying at the start of the case, because all of Gale's jewellery remained on her body. However, one item was missing, a Seconda watch with a round black face, finished with gold details and Roman numerals. The watch also featured a constellation of stars and a moving moon feature. It has never been recovered. Gale's case is possibly linked to that of 22-year-old Janine Downs, who was a friend of Gale's and also a sex worker. Janine was found deceased on February 2nd of 1991. She had been sexually assaulted and strangled before her body was dumped on the side of the A464 outside the town of Shifnal. Janine was a mother of three who'd reportedly claimed to know who killed Gale. Her friends said that she'd refused to go to the police with what she knew, as the culprit had given her a lot of trouble before. It's been theorized that Janine was killed because she could identify Gale's murderer. Suspects in the cases of both women include Christopher Halliwell, who is currently serving time for the murders of Sean O'Callaghan and Becky Godden, and who is also suspected of being involved with the disappearance of Claudia Lawrence. There is also a man named John Taylor, who is in prison for the slaying of 16-year-old Leanne Tiernan in November of 2000. Taylor is also thought to have been linked with at least four other cases, where the victims were all sex workers. A serial rapist named David Williams was, at one point, charged with the murder of Gale, but was later acquitted. In recent years, her case has been sadly forgotten about, and is still unsolved. If you have any information pertaining to this case, you can contact Crime Stoppers UK at 0800 555 111. Cindy Crossthwaite. Our next case comes from the much sunnier backdrop of Victoria, Australia, a location chosen by an anonymous patron. The suburb of Melton is located in Melbourne and is home to a colourful yearly festival, lush green golf courses, and of course, a handful of monstrous cold cases. On June 20th of 2007, 41-year-old Cindy Crossthwaite dropped off her two eldest children at school at around 9 o'clock in the morning. The trio exchanged goodbyes and Cindy waved her children off until they entered the school building. After this, she was never seen alive again. Throughout the day, Cindy's father Philip attempted to contact her, but repeatedly failed to get through. He became all the more concerned when the mother of three never returned to pick up her children after school. Wondering if perhaps she had just suddenly fallen ill, Philip headed over to Cindy's house in Melton to check on her. When he stepped into the home, he was horrified to find his daughter lying dead in the entranceway. Cindy had been so brutally beaten that she was unrecognizable. The only way Philip could discern that this was his child was from the scars on her body from a motorcycle accident some 20 years earlier. Described as kind and hardworking, Cindy was a proud mother who loved her kids more than anything. Her friends said she was always bubbly and loved to talk, and she was incredibly capable, running her own consultancy as a production accountant. However, things weren't quite so glittering behind the scenes. According to her family, Cindy had a way of attracting the worst kind of partners, men who were aggressive, violent, and disrespectful. Her history of toxic and abusive relationships made it difficult for authorities to determine where to begin. In the summer of 2005, just 2 years before her death, Cindy separated from her husband, Emil Petrov, who often went by Billy, and whom she'd met a decade and a half earlier in 1989. Emil was not the perfect husband by any stretch of the imagination. He had severe alcohol problems, which resulted in him losing his license several times over, although Cindy's brother said he often still drove his car anyway. The couple were on and off for around 9 years, and Emil's parents were a huge source of conflicts between the two, as they demanded that Cindy take on the role of traditional housewife and sign over all her assets, including her house, to Emil. The pair did marry in 1996, but argued often, and the parents continued to cause problems between the pair. Together, Cindy and Emil had 2 children, Nicholas and Jasmine, and they raised them in a house in Melton, near to where Philip lived. By 2000, Cindy wanted to leave the relationship, but it dragged on another 4 years, slowly deteriorating as Emil engaged in odd behaviours. He continued to drink heavily, inflicted injuries upon himself in front of the children, and even once attempted to burn down the house. This was the last straw for Cindy, who separated from Emil and eventually moved away to live with her new boyfriend, whose child she was carrying. But that relationship soon ended when her boyfriend became volatile after taking a new medication, so Cindy returned to Melton South after the birth of her 3rd child. Despite being separated from Emil, he continued to show up unannounced at her house and attempted to persuade her to take him back. Once in 2005, Cindy found that her car had been tampered with, but this was only the beginning. By the time 2007 rolled around, Cindy was living in fear. She felt like someone was constantly watching her. She answered her phone only to endure eerie silence or murmured threats, and she'd find her garden furniture rearranged most days. She even found her dog injured before it eventually went missing. People close to the mother of 3 soon found themselves in the crosshairs of her unidentified stalker, with one friend so terrified for the safety of her family that she moved 4 times in 5 years. Cindy kept handwritten logs of all the strange events, and also kept her solicitor in the loop. When authorities arrived at the crime scene that summer, they had to identify Cindy's body via DNA and fingerprints. Her youngest son, Jonas, who was just 15 months old, was lying on her bed, thankfully unharmed. Cindy's case appears to have stalled very early on in the investigation and was reopened in 2011. In 2017, a $1 million reward was offered, and her 2 oldest children, now both young adults, appealed for help. In 2019, Cindy's ex-husband and the father of her 2 children, Emil Petrov, was arrested and charged with the 41-year-old's murder. Another man, 50-year-old Brian O'Shea, was also charged. According to O'Shea's brother, Laurie, he had been following Cindy on behalf of her former husband. O'Shea also took Laurie to a house and told him that he'd be receiving this house, which was in Melton South, in exchange for helping Emil. He also reportedly told Laurie that he'd purchased a gun with the intention of using it to get rid of Cindy, and even claimed that Emil had hit Cindy with the butt of the gun. As it stands, there have been no new updates in Cindy's case since November of 2019. Cindy's 2 oldest children, who were both raised by their grandfather Philip, have noted their mix of emotions at the news, but are glad to finally have some answers. If you have any information pertaining to this case, you can contact Crime Stoppers Australia at 1-800-333-000. Carla Corley. Our only US-based case this month comes from an anonymous patron who chose Birmingham, Alabama. Although it's had its fair share of dark and odd cases, that of missing Carla Corley is perhaps one of the most peculiar in its history. 14-year-old Carla Corley was last seen alive on the night of August 12, 1980, at her family's residence located at Eastwood Public Housing Project on Airport Highway. That evening, Carla and her mother washed up the dishes together before settling down to watch TV. However, Carla's mother was tired and so went to bed before the 14-year-old did. At 4:30 a.m., Carla's mother awoke to find the house still and empty. She left her room and found the apartment doors wide open, chairs had been knocked back from the living room table, and a bottle of fizzy juice had been overturned. Carla's new sandals were still by the couch where the 14-year-old had left them the night before, and her belt was lying on the ground outside the front door. All of her other belongings, including money and medication, as Carla suffered from epilepsy, remained in the house. The truth as to how the authorities were contacted here becomes a little muddy due to conflicting articles and reports. Some indicate that it was Carla's older sister, Kat, who had moved out of the family home at the time, who first contacted the authorities, after she was unable to reach Carla on the phone. Other reports suggest that it was Carla's mother who contacted the authorities. What we do know, however, is that according to the Charlie Project and several news sources, just 1 month prior to her disappearance, Carla had been abducted and sexually assaulted by a group of men. The attack occurred near Lake Purdy, Alabama, and lasted 3 hours. The details of this assault are murky at best, and where they fit into the story is rather confusing. It appears that neither Carla's sister nor the authorities learned of this incident until 18 years after the teenager disappeared, as no official report was ever made. It's unclear whether or not her mother knew, and if she did, why she failed to inform authorities. The men apparently came to the family residence the week before Carla vanished, but they were forbidden from entering the home. It is uncertain whether these men were involved with the 14-year-old's vanishing, but it seems like it could be a very strong possibility. Since Carla disappeared, her young mother has tragically fallen victim to several con men claiming to know where the young girl was, but would only reveal the information after being paid. Several years after she vanished, Carla's mother declared her dead. She also stated her belief that the 14-year-old was sexually assaulted and murdered after being taken. Reportedly, Carla's sister Kat has been told that she'd be killed if she keeps looking for Carla, but she has persisted anyway. Kat doesn't believe that her sister would go this long without speaking to her if she was alive. According to one news article, an investigator close to the case who was assigned to it around 3 years after Carla's disappearance claimed that the teenager had been located in South Alabama and was a runaway who was living her own life. Kat does not believe this. Theories in the 14-year-old's case are limited. Most believe that the group of men who assaulted Carla were involved, while others suspect that her mother had a hand in what happened. However, without any evidence, it is impossible to say. Reportedly, one suspect claimed to know Carla's fate, but later recanted his story. There is little to no information about this individual available online. During the course of the investigation, several excavations were carried out, the most recent being in 2005. However, Carla has never been located. If you have any information pertaining to this case, you can call the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children on 1-800-843-5678. Tanisha Melbourne Blake. Our final case comes from our patron Hattie Ring, who chose Enfield in North London as their location. Although Enfield is most certainly not free of crime, detailed reports of cases in the area are tough to come by. However, the district of Tottenham, just 20 minutes away, is another story. Tanisha Melbourne Blake was a cheerful and vibrant 17-year-old. Popular and well-liked, friends and family described her as a girl with a bubbly personality who could light up a room with her presence. An incredibly hard worker, Tanisha had big plans for her future. Although she was still young herself, the teenager was a volunteer mentor to young people at Bruce Grove Youth Space in Haringey and had taken part in multiple anti-knife and gun crime events. Her ultimate goal was to become a youth worker. However, Tanisha was robbed of the chance to realize her dreams when she was gunned down on the street while hanging out with her friends in Charles Grove Road on April 2nd, 2018. At around 9:35 p.m., shots were fired from a car into a group of people gathered outside a block of flats. The 17-year-old was hit in the heart and died at the scene, leaving behind grieving parents and seven siblings. The vehicle used by the perpetrators was a grey or silver Vauxhall Mariva people carrier and was found burnt out in Fordham Road, Barnet, 5 days after the shooting. Police believe there were at least two people in the vehicle. At least two more bullets were shot in the street before the culprits fled. The handgun used in the crime was located by a civilian who discovered it wrapped in a towel inside a bag on Tudor Close in Highgate, North London on May 19th. Just weeks after the incident, the serial number had been removed from the weapon, which is described as a checkmade Browning, but forensic testing on the bullet from Tanisha's body showed that the same weapon had been used to gun down a 20-year-old just 1 month earlier. Joseph William Torres was shot and killed on Essex Close on March 14th. Joseph, described by family and friends as a kind and caring young man, was approached by three hooded figures who shot him in the chest and legs while he and a friend sat in a van. He had no gang affiliations and was reportedly murdered due to a mix-up since he was wearing the same beanie as the intended victim. Each of the men who participated in the attack have since been found guilty and jailed. The gun that took the lives of both Joseph and Tanisha has also been linked to three other gang shootings that took place in 2017. After 2017, the authorities suspect that the weapon changed hands and was offloaded to another gang. Since Tanisha's demise, the gun has been taken off the streets. Detective Chief Inspector Neil John said there was no suggestion that Tanisha's case was linked with Joseph's outside of the murder weapon, which is believed to have been a, quote, gun for hire. Tanisha had no gang affiliations, and her death is believed to have been part of an ongoing dispute between two rival gangs in the area. The suspect in the shooting is described as a black male with a slit or two in his left eyebrow who was wearing black clothing, including black gloves. Between March and April of 2019, five people were held in connection with the incident, three of whom were aged between 18 and 30, and who were released pending further investigation. The other two men were released with no further action taken. A sixth man, aged 30, was arrested in February 2020. However, so far, Tanisha's case remains unsolved. If you have any information pertaining to this case, you can call the Incident Room on 020-8358-0100. And there you have the facts. Thank you so much to all our Patreon supporters, and congratulations to those who won, and good luck to all those entering into next week's Too Close to Home prize draw. Feel free to leave a comment down below with your own theories and speculations relating to any of these cases, and remember to like this video and subscribe to support the channel. Thank you for watching. Stay alert, stay safe, and I'll see you next time.